that I, Charles Hoffman, have been taping for the Stony Brook Archives. The period covered here is the period of my stay at Stony Brook, 1963 to 1979, when I took early retirement. Tape number one, which was taped on October 16th, 1987, at Stony Brook in Carl Hartzell's office, covered my academic activities. Basically, there were three main headings there. The Department of Economics, which I came to in 1963 and was acting chairman until Bob Cashman was recruited in 1965. The second area covered was the Federated Learning Communities, a program that still operates in Stony Brook and started in the mid to late 70s. And I was the first faculty participant after Pat Hill, who was a director of the program. I was the term that was used was master learner. And the third aspect of academic activities was faculty development, both under the American Historical Association grants and other local activities. That completed tape number one. Tape number two, which was taped at the beginning of 1988, and for which this tape number three, which is being taped in February 1988, is a continuation. At the end of tape three, I was still talking about the China Committee, in particular its thrust to develop on video an introductory course on China. And it was successful in creating several modules for that course. I know that I used one or two of them in my course on China. How it was used by the others, I'm not certain. At any rate, the end of tape two completed the discussion on that committee and on the chancellor's visit to China arranged through the committee. I want to continue on this tape on the China outreach, focusing, however, on Stony Brook rather than on campus-wide efforts. The China outreach that was achieved on a SUNY-wide basis through the SUNY-wide China Committee and through the efforts of its members was continued as relations with China developed and more individual campuses moved on to make their own arrangements. The China Committee continued, but it no longer had the thrust that it had before. Moving our focus then from the SUNY-wide China activities to the Stony Brook China activities, we see that C.N. Young played, as one would expect, a significant role in the development of Stony Brook's relations with Chinese institutions specifically and in a general way. I worked very closely with C.N. Young, and when we did have visitors from the People's Republic of China on campus, the two of us were usually joint hosts, though it was Professor Young's contacts with colleagues in physics and former colleagues or students in China. That was the basis for our early contacts. C.N. Young went to China very early on, before President Nixon made his historic trip. I went shortly after Nixon's trip, and by that time Professor Young had been going to China when it was when he felt like, in terms of projects he had underway. Professor Young was in China in July of 1973, the same time I was there, only there was a slight difference. He was given an audience with Chairman Mao Zedong, an audience that was publicized in the Chinese press, and of course it was also picked up in the U.S. press. The first outreach to China from Stony Brook came on an initiative that I took with the Peking Library. As a result of contacts that I had through the SUNY-wide China Committee, I made contact with the State Education Department librarian, and there had been some correspondence in which that library found out that the Beijing library, as well as other libraries, were interested in getting all of the works of Lewis Henry Morgan. Footnote on Morgan, Lewis Henry Morgan was a 19th century American businessman who lived in the Buffalo area and who was a kind of amateur anthropologist, ethnologist, and some of his writings were seen by Marxists as corroboration of a Marxist theory of cultural social development, and of the Marxist theory as it was interpreted in the context of primitive peoples and developing peoples. After my contact with the library in Albany, through our library at Stony Brook, we made contact with the Peking or Beijing library and offered to try to get any of the works they wanted. They sent us a list, and I was able, with the help of a good friend, a historian friend, who had access to all of Morgan's bibliography, to get up a checklist and to succeed in identifying and acquiring many of these books. As a result, the basis was set for an exchange, and it was agreed upon. And as a matter of interest, in my first trip to China in July of 1973, I took the first books that were gifts from the Stony Brook Library to the Beijing Library. Incidentally, you will find that among the materials that I gave to Carl Hartzell that was Xeroxed are the letters, as well as news coverage items, on this whole library exchange affair, which I think ultimately was a front page story on in the New York Times. We were very happy to start this exchange, and it broadened after the first sending of Morgan's works. Of course, we put in requests for materials that we want, and I don't know what happened to continuing exchange in the late 70s and after I left Stony Brook. Another aspect of Stony Brook's China reach was hosting visitors from the People's Republic. And remember, this was occurring in the early and middle 1970s, before there was complete normalization of relations with China, that which was accomplished in the Carter administration. But before that, we had had a number of distinguished visitors. Once again, it was Professor C.N. Young who had the contacts, and we used to get these visitors coming on their own projects, but they came back to Stony Brook over time. The most distinguished among these visitors was Joe Peiwen, who is still alive and is sort of the dean of Chinese scientists. He's a physicist who did his work at Caltech many, many decades ago. He must be in his 80s now. He still had a wonderful command of the English language. I had met Joe Peiwen in Beijing when I was there the first time and visited Beijing University and Tsinghua, the Science and Technology University. He was president of one of those universities. I think it was Beijing, but I'm not certain. Of course, he's held the highest science positions in the governmental structure. And to this day, he's very active. He's a member of Chinese People's Political Consultative Council, which is the non-communist representative group of the various organizations and movements that were allied to the communists when they took over the mainland of China. In addition to Joe Peiwen, one visitor we had a number of times was Chang Wenyu, who also is a physicist. As a matter of fact, he and his wife were physics professors at, I think it was Indiana University, possibly Purdue, but I think it was Indiana, back in the late 40s and early 50s. As a matter of fact, after the communists took control in 1949, they tried to go back to China, but they had great difficulty because, if you recall, that was the McCarthy period, and atmosphere was, to put it mildly, very restrictive. And so it was only after considerable difficulty that they were able to get back to China and to take an important role in the scientific development of the People's Republic. As a matter of fact, I saw Chang Wenyu when I was in China the first time in 1973, and I think I may have seen him one other time. He became the director of the High Energy Physics Institute in the northwest part of Beijing. I don't know whether he still is. He probably is retired by now, but it's possible that he's still active. Another Stony Brook faculty member who was involved in this was Sheldon Chang of the Electrical Engineering Department in the School of Engineering. He may have been a student of one of these visitors. Both he and C.N. Young were undergraduates in China and left China in the 40s, before the revolution was successful. There were engineers who came to visit at Stony Brook, and here I'm talking about people who were visit for a day or so. I'll talk later about others. One of the engineers who visited, and I've forgotten his name, was the one in charge of the designing or the design of the memorial building, the Mao Memorial Building in Tiananmen Square in Beijing. That was a building that was designed and completed in less than a year. And so we had a chance to hear his comments on that whole process. So what I'm trying to depict is a flow. It wasn't steady in the sense of continuous, but we would have a flow of visitors from the People's Republic. Many of them attracted to Stony Brook only because C.N. Yang was there and they knew him either personally or by reputation. So this is what happened. Now, as the Academy of Sciences in the United States developed its contacts and set up a committee on scholarly communication with the People's Republic of China, which is still functioning these days and has an office in China, in Beijing. As a matter of fact, it was in the same compound I lived in when my wife and I were there early in 1987. The committee under the National Academy of Sciences worked very hard to develop protocols, procedures for exchange. And as a matter of fact, the beginning flow of scholars and scientists from China was later in the 70s reversed in a flow of members of our faculty and others to China. The most prominent of these was the visit by John Toll and science colleagues under the auspices of the Committee on Scholarly Communication of the National Academy of Sciences. And with John Toll and his wife and spouses, I guess, of the other members of that delegation were other outstanding physicists. I don't remember their names. I remember one of them was the director of SLAC at Stanford, and there were other people of that caliber. C.N. Yang and I spent much of one day giving orientation talks on China and responding to questions from members of the group who were at Stony Brook. In addition, there were other members of our faculty who went to China in various roles. I don't remember all of them, but the flow grew as our contacts grew, and of course, as there was a formalization of exchanges. One of the early exchanges we had was from different institutions. Fudan University in Shanghai is a university where C.N. Yang's father had been a professor of mathematics, and he had contacts there. So we had some people. One I remember was Gu Chaohao, who was a professor in math and physics at Fudan, and who collaborated with C.N. Yang. I think they had one article that was published. He came over for a year, and along with him there were other people, not all from Fudan. I remember there was one professor of engineering who taught in our electrical engineering department, and who brought his son and niece over and got them started as undergraduates in the Stony Brook program. They stayed on when he went back to China after his year or so was up. Actually, I've had contact with him over the years. At the time he came to Stony Brook, he came from the northeastern part of China, Manchuria, one of the technical colleges or universities there. He is now at the university in Xiamen, which is in the southern part of China, a beautiful city. He was a dean there. I don't know if he still is. I went on several trips to China while I was still active at Stony Brook. I went in July of 1973 and in May of 1978. After I retired in 1979, I went back to China in 1983, where I was a faculty member at the Institute of International Economic Management in Beijing, and then again in 1987, where I was a visiting professor at the University of International Business and Economics. In addition to these trips, I carried on correspondence with some colleagues and developed programs contributing to the East Asian Studies program at Stony Brook. Members of that program, like Professor Lee, also had a keen interest in China and did go to China at different points in time. Professor Lee went to Hong Kong frequently because his wife's family was there, but he also went on professional business. One of the concrete outcomes of these contacts with China and the early exchanges, most of which were in one direction from China to Stony Brook, was eventually an agreement on a formal agreement on exchange program with Fudan University in Shanghai. Fudan University is one of the key universities in China, key universities being those that are, one, financed by the central government, and two, universities with the highest standards in the country. I think I indicated earlier that Fudan was a university that C.N. Yang had considerable contact with, and since his father had been a professor of mathematics there, he also had a knowledge of the university, and he was held in high esteem, not just because of his being a Nobel laureate. At any rate, the contacts with Fudan led eventually to this agreement that I mentioned, in which they sent students and faculty, beginning in the sciences, and we sent some students, I don't know how many, but I remember that one of my graduate students in Asian Studies, Jeanette Ford, was there for at least a year, had a command of the language, and pursued her studies as an Asian Studies history major. Our early contacts with Fudan faculty and officials were with a couple of vice presidents. One was sort of like an academic vice president. He was fairly old, and eventually he was retired. He had with him another vice president who was also an academic. She was a scientist, and if I'm not mistaken, she was a biologist. She came to the United States more than once, And I had contact with them at their first in their first visit to Stony Brook, and I corresponded with her. She eventually was given an honorary degree by the City University of New York City College, and in recent years she became president of Fudan University. Her name was Xia Sida. And the last time I was in China, she was still president. Some of my contacts continued over the years, and one in particular, we exchange Christmas cards every year. But I have not been to Fudan in my recent visits to China. Among the contacts from China that were made were those by C.N. Yang in physics. And he invited a number of young physicists to spend time at the Institute of Theoretical Physics at Stony Brook. And even after I retired, I occasionally visited and had a chance to speak to him about these visitors and what some of their qualities were, what some of the problems were. One of the problems that we had spoken about over the years was that they were very narrowly specialized. As he put it, undergraduates in physics didn't major in physics, they majored in optics or some such field of physics, so that when they graduated, they were very narrowly trained. Fortunately for China, the curricula are being modified considerably so that that kind of early narrow specialization is being superseded. This idiosyncratic development of Chinese scientists or scholars isn't just something that is characteristic and can be just viewed as an anomaly. It it also makes it difficult for scholarly and scientific communication to occur, and it also makes it difficult for the individuals to learn as much when they come, let's say, to an institute and have to interact with people from various areas. And even though they may be very adept at an aspect of their discipline, their ability to assimilate very much is limited. This completes the section on my experiences in various aspects of administration in the period that I was at Stony Brook, that is from 1963 through 1979. I will move on now to another section, probably the last section in my taping. The preceding two sections have focused on one, academic developments that I experienced and was involved in, and two, administrative developments, mainly on the Stony Brook campus, but also including inter-campus, university-wide activities. In these, there has been a sense of the construction, the erection of buildings, programs, and the developments thereby of a multiversity. Now, in this last section, I want to talk about more problematic issues to try to give the fabric of change, more controversial issues, so that one gets a sense of the construction occurring in a very dynamic context in which there were cross currents, in which there were different groups and individuals trying to achieve ends, some of them related to the campus and the university's programs, others
related to the campus, but also to issues that transcended the campus, whether they were national political issues or national or regional movements, social, political, and so forth. This intermixture of campus and transcampus problems and issues, obviously, I am giving my view of what I saw happen and my interpretation of significance and my critical response to some of them. I don't expect that what I'm giving is the definitive view, but I'm trying here to come up with issues and events and a process that will give a more realistic fabric to the development of Stony Brook as a multiversity. It is hoped that this exercise will give a more realistic tone to the construction of a physical campus and of programs and of an intellectual atmosphere, so that what we see is a picture that is real, not surreal, and not romanticized or idealized. The 1960s, of course, are known for the protests against the Vietnam War. They're also known for the horrible assassinations that went on, starting with the assassination of President Kennedy in 1963. Later in that decade, the assassinations of Robert Kennedy, running for the presidency, and Martin Luther King. These assassinations set a tone. One thing that should not be forgotten is the numbness that was achieved, that was spread throughout the country by these assassinations, which set the stamp of violence that characterized much of the protest movement, some of the student movement, not just in the United States, but throughout the world. In France, remember, in 1968, there were student riots and violence. Of course, this is a period in China of the Cultural Revolution. So the tone, the atmosphere, the emotional sensitivities of people, some of whom were not even aware of how they had been affected, all of these were important elements of the emotion tones of the decade. The 1970s, the early part of which marked the running down of the Vietnam War. The 1970s were a period of consolidation, assimilation of the changes that had come about in the 1960s. Looking more closely at the Stony Brook campus in the context of this period of tremendous upheaval, change within and outside the university. The Vietnam War, of course, was the focus and the detonator of many of the events and movements that we saw active on campus. In the early 60s, as I recall, when I came to Stony Brook, remember that was 1963, I found myself in the beginning to be almost alone in my opposition to the Vietnam War. Colleagues of all stripes were supportive of the war, and as a matter of fact, the terminology was very interesting because they spoke of the possibility of another Munich if we did not fight the war. That changed. Didn't change swiftly, but it changed not at a very slow pace, so that by the middle and later years of the 1960s, the attitudes and positions of faculty on campus more and more were against the war. Perhaps this was another example of the impact of television, 6 o'clock news, the repeated portrayal of action against civilians and others in Vietnam. At any rate, this change was to some extent, I think, caused by what was going on the campus itself. The students were more and more active in their protest against the war. Remember that many of them were in college to escape the draft. It was a, quote, rich man's, unquote, way of escaping the draft. They were under pressure, however, to maintain an acceptable performance level. That meant that many of them were, shall we say, looking for courses that would not be too demanding. I'm not suggesting that that's the only reason for the very strong student push to change curriculum requirements, to reduce the number of requirements, and to allow for an expanding number of elective courses in those areas which traditionally had been required course areas, that is, the basic general education areas, social sciences, sciences, humanities. Now, even if there were requirements in those areas, they were set up in a manner that students could elect. There was also a cutting back in the requirement of languages. There was a cutting back in the requirement of mathematics, and so forth and so on. In any event, this, as we know today, had a very significant impact on curricula throughout the United States. At Stony Brook, this change in curriculum meant changes not just for students, but also for the financing and staffing of curricula in different departments. There was a shift, a reallocation of resources as the result now of consumers, the students, having more of a say as to which courses were to have large enrollment. The achievement of these changes on the campus, as well as the achievement of changes in the official position on Vietnam, were brought about by, on campus that is, by sit-ins, teach-ins. There, of course, were mass protest meetings on campus, as well as co-joined protests in Washington and other parts of the country. And there was, of course, the famous march to the Pentagon. And there were individuals from Stony Brook student body and faculty who were ones who tried to penetrate the Pentagon in that very well-known confrontation. One of my colleagues in the economics department, Michael Zweig, was among those at the Pentagon. At the end of the decade, in 1970 to be precise, we had the explosions that came about in consequence to the United States incursion in Cambodia. I was on sabbatical leave that year, but I did come back to Stony Brook in the spring of 1970. So I experienced the explosion both at Berkeley, where I was teaching a research seminar, and at Stony Brook. And of course, the Kent State and other campus explosions added fuel to the fire of protest at the United States' invasion of Cambodia, a non-participant in the Vietnam War. The 1960s was also a period in which spin-offs from the student protests took other forms, most particularly black students were trying to get curriculum changes which would enhance their position in terms of giving them courses they could deal with more readily, but also giving them courses which would reflect their highest sense of identity in terms of the role of blacks in the history and sociology and economics of the development of the United States. So, as indicated elsewhere, many of us, including myself, were involved in attempts to come to grips with the problems that these protest movements brought to the fore. And of course, one way was in providing support for affirmative action in bringing more black and minority students and women onto the campus, and also providing them with a curricula that were more reflective of their interests in the roles that their groups played in the development of this country and in the world's development. It is in this context that I want to look now at important events that occurred in the 60s and into the 70s. One controversial area was the area of the quality of student life on campus. And this was the consequence of a number of forces at work. First, remember that in the 60s, Stony Brook was very small. And at the outset, each entering freshman class was as large, if not larger, than the rest of the student body. There was, therefore, not a stable situation into which new students came. And of course, if anything, this exacerbated any sense of anomie that students had coming to college, getting adjusted, finding their role, deciding which directions they were going to go into, toward, and so forth. The situation of anomie, the situation of not having standards, not having a stable social and physical situation to come to, was made worse by the fact that in those periods when students had leisure time, such as on the weekends or in the evening, time beyond their studying, there was almost nothing they could do on campus. Except, of course, generating interaction with other students. But we did not have, in the early years, adequate athletic facilities. We had no student center. Students lived in dorms, and they made do in the best way they could. It took years until we had the physical facilities. Incidentally, there was no ready substitute close by to campus because the Stony Brook area was not a very heavily populated area and didn't have many social facilities. There were some bars, but there was very little. This meant that many students went home on the weekends if they were living close enough to home, and there was a considerable number who could do that. But it meant that the social life of the campus was primitive, to put it mildly. Another element in the poor quality of life was that there was constant construction going on. Unfortunately, that construction disrupted the usual avenues of access, ingress, and outgress among the buildings, dorms, library, classrooms. Now, it was not set up in such a way as to take into account the needs of students and faculty and staff. Anyone who was walking around the campus was walking on an obstacle course, and oftentimes there was not sufficient care taken to assure that people would not get hurt. As a matter of fact, one terrible tragedy indicated the extent to which getting around campus made life more complicated. One night, a small group of students was walking on campus, and one of them either fell or slipped or was possibly pushed into an open manhole and was killed by scalding. This brought to the fore the problem of poor quality of life, just in terms of walking around campus. And it's my own judgment that there was less concern at the upper levels of the administration about the quality of student life, the quality of the physical conditions on campus, than there ought to have been. I think that this attitude is related to the basic outlook of those who were making the decisions on campus. And I realize this is a very controversial point that I'm making, but it is my sense that the top